Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Conversations with Annalisa Barbieri. I first met and spoke to the guest in this week's episode, Katie Russell, when she was the Media and Communications Officer for Rape Crisis UK. That was a couple of years ago. As soon as I launched my podcast, I knew I wanted to do an episode with Katie. Why? Because despite the subject matter being difficult and depressing, it is really important. Despite the amount of information out there, I still get letters from people asking, was it rape? They might caveat it with, but I knew him, or I was drunk. Sex without consent is always rape. It doesn't matter how many times you've had sex with a person before, or how well you know them. In this episode, we discuss what rape is and the difference between that and sexual assault. We also discuss other matters of sexual violence. The legislation we refer to is the 2003 Sexual Offences Act. I'll put the link in the episode description. I know that sometimes survivors find it helpful to see the law spelt out in black and white. And please note that where we do discuss the law, we mean the law in England and Wales. It may be different where you are. We discuss consent in detail about how it's an active, not a passive concept, i.e. you have to actively have consented to something, and what to do if you've been the victim of sexual violence or know someone who has. Katie refers to SARVSL, S-A-R-V-S-L, in this episode, which stands for Support After Rape and Sexual Violence Leeds, the organisation of which she is now CEO. Katie is a specialist in the subject of sexual violence and abuse against women and girls. She has over 18 years diverse experience within the rape crisis movement and the wider voluntary and community sector. I'll talk about other helpful organisations at the end of this episode. I particularly like men and boys to listen to this, since it's so often women who seek to inform themselves. So do please share it. If you're a parent or carer, you may want to listen to this with your teenage children once you've listened to it yourself first to make sure it's suitable. If you'd like to listen to this podcast ad-free and before it goes on general release, please consider becoming a patron from just £3 a month, or you can give a one-off donation via Acast Supporter. Both links will be in the episode description. Katie, hello and welcome to this episode. This is an extremely difficult subject, but I think it's one that's very necessary. Can we start off by me asking you, what is rape?
So I'm very loath to overcomplicate it, because I think we hear people refer to rape and different forms of sexual violence as grey areas or as complex far too often. But I think it is important to start by saying that there's rape in law, and then there's a wider definition of rape that we might use to define our own experiences. So I'll start with rape in law. We should recognise as well that there's a lot about the law that can be extremely helpful in sort of validating our own experiences. And I think we often find actually that even if we don't know the law, we haven't memorised parts of legislation, which are often quite jargony. When we find out what the law is, it's often quite gratifying to find that it marries up very well with our own instincts.
Absolutely.
So it's useful to look at the Sexual Offences Act 2003, which is the main piece of legislation that covers sexual offences for England and Wales. And there, rape is clearly defined as the penetration of someone's vagina, mouth or anus with a penis without consent. And I'll come back to consent. So in law, rape can only be perpetrated by someone with a penis, but it does cover non-consensual penetration of the vagina, the anus, and the mouth. And then there is another offence called sexual assault by penetration, which covers the non-consensual penetration of the vagina or anus with something other than a penis. So it could be another body part, like a hand or a tongue, or it could be an object. And outrageously, you know, those kinds of sexual assault are also very common experiences. And I suppose the reason why I say that the law doesn't necessarily always marry up with individuals' experiences is because certainly in the rape crisis movement, where we're very much led by survivors of sexual violence and abuse, for survivors of sexual violence and abuse, and we're very survivor focused, we recognise that, you know, experiences of sexual violence are so disempowering that we're particularly sensitive to never inadvertently or sort of accidentally disempowering someone further by trying to define their experience for them. So we're very much led by the language that women and girls, in my case at Sarsville, because we're a women and girls only organisation, but people of all genders come to us with when they want to talk about their own experiences of sexual violence and abuse. And we'd never tell you, no, you weren't raped because you were assaulted with a bottle, for example. If that's the language you're using, that's the language we're using. But central to whether we're talking about rape or whether we're talking about sexual assault is this issue of consent. And that's really what is fundamental and central. And again, the 2003 Sexual Offences Act, no legislation is perfect, but when we go back and look at it, it's an extremely progressive and useful piece of legislation compared to what we had before in England and Wales and compared to what other countries have in other parts of Europe and the world. And part of the reason why it's so clear and progressive is because it gives a clear definition of what consent is. And it's clear that consent is an active, not a passive concept. So what I mean by that is it defines consent as when someone agrees by choice and has the freedom and capacity to make that choice. So that means that if you are asleep, you cannot consent because you haven't agreed by choice. You haven't had freedom and capacity to make a choice. It means if you are incapacitated through alcohol or drugs, whether you've taken those voluntarily or whether they've been administered to you without your knowledge or forcibly, you don't have the freedom, the capacity to make a choice to consent. So sex with you would always be non-consensual. That would always be rape in those circumstances. Likewise, if you're under the age of consent, which is 16 in England and Wales, or if you have been threatened, coerced, frightened into agreeing to do something, the law recognises that that's still not genuine consent, because you may have agreed, but you haven't agreed by choice. You haven't made a free choice. You haven't had capacity to make that choice. So it's really useful to think about it, I find. I mean, I never want to minimise experiences of sexual violence by making sort of flippant comparisons to other things. And that can be very offensive, very triggering for survivors. I appreciate that, especially as in the past, I think rape apologists and people who want to dismiss individuals' experiences of rape will say, you know, really outrageous things, kind of comparing women's bodies to property, for example, and say things like, well, you shouldn't leave your car unlocked if you don't want it to be stolen, as some kind of argument for people asking for it because they're wearing certain kinds of clothes or whatever it may be. So I certainly don't want to, you know, my comments to kind of be taken in that kind of vein. But I do think it's useful to think about that concept of consent in other contexts away from anything sexual, because when we do that, we can see just how easy it is. So if we think about something totally different, like money, if I was standing at a cash point and somebody came up behind me with a knife and said, give me your PIN number, and I gave them my PIN number and they withdrew all my money, nobody would say, that I had consented to them taking all my money. Mm. And yet, when it comes to sexual activity, so often someone will say, well, she said yes, or worse than that, she didn't say no, or she didn't put up a fight.
Yeah.
And what's so dangerous is that people in the general population genuinely believe that if someone hasn't fought back, if they haven't screamed, if they haven't said the word no, then they've consented by default. And that is simply not, and it's not morally the way that consent works, and it's not legally the way that consent works either. And I think for survivors, it's also important to hear that quite often we find in those situations of trauma and shock that we can't say no and we can't fight because our bodies often either freeze or go completely limp. Now, I think a lot of people are familiar with the phrase fight or flight, but actually there are five recognized F's when it comes to that adrenaline response, that fear response. There's fight or flight, but they're actually not the most common responses to those kinds of traumatic experiences. There's also freeze, flop, and friend. And those are three different ways in which, in those terrifying situations, our brains will often take over and respond instinctively for our own survival. So in the same way that an animal in the wild might freeze in the presence of a predator, or you might freeze when you see something else that you're incredibly scared of. I've got a terrible phobia of rats. And when I see a rat, I don't run in the other direction. I freeze on the spot. And the ways that we can understand that our body does those things in those kinds of circumstances, so often survivors come to us blaming themselves because they say, I just froze, I couldn't even speak, I didn't say anything. And then they even, especially because, again, infuriatingly, sadly, whatever the right adverb is, perpetrators are so often someone known, even trusted or loved before the event, that a survivor will sometimes come to us trying to make excuses for that person, trying to explain away their behaviour. And they might say, well, I didn't say no, or I didn't fight them off, I just froze, so maybe they thought that I wanted it. But the body freezes in those circumstances in order to prevent further damage. So again, sometimes survivors come to us blaming themselves. Sometimes they come to us angry with their body for letting them down in that situation. And we say, actually, what your body did for you there is sense a dangerous situation and try to save you.
Yeah, it protects you, doesn't it? It helps you survive. I mean, I think it's really important, and thank you, because I was going to talk about the trauma response. We sort of hear the fight, flight, freeze, and some people, they don't know how they're going to respond. And also, it's really important for people to understand they have no control. When your body goes into a trauma response, it's a reptilian part of your brain which takes over. And just like animals play dead in the wild, that's what our body does. We cannot control it. And it's really to try and keep us safe. You may not feel safe, but it's about survival. I mean, the other one is the kind of the friend. I call it the appease response, where you can actually try and make it okay for the person. Mm. And also sometimes women don't know what's happened till after. They go into a shock response. Mm. I hear that a lot. And they say, you know, I kind of, it's only sort of 2 or 3 days later, but then they'll blame themselves. But, you know, I said I had a really nice time, or I did that. Because I think for a really long time, people see the idea of an attacker, a perpetrator, as someone you don't know in an alley. No, I grew up in the sort of 80s. I was a child in the 70s. That's what I would have described a rapist or an attacker. I was sexually assaulted when I was 11, and I didn't even know till I was 40 that that's what had happened to me, because I didn't have the language and I didn't understand what was happening to me. Can we just talk a little bit, just my original question, about what's the difference between rape and sexual assault?
Well, it still absolutely hinges on this issue of consent, and that's fundamental to any kind of sexual violence. I often use the term sexual violence or sexual violence and abuse as a kind of broad catch-all, but sexual assault, again, there are different types within the act, and I should have started by saying I'm not a lawyer or a legal expert myself, but these are my sort of working understanding of this legislation. But sexual assault is basically any other kind of unwanted sexual contact. So beyond the rape and sexual assault by penetration that I've just described, it's any other kind of unwanted sexual contact from one person to another where the second person hasn't consented. Really, it has to be sexual in nature. And again, these are the kinds of things that will get debated when these kinds of issues come to court. There are sort of high profile cases where someone has had an unwanted physical contact, and the defence has essentially been that contact wasn't sexual in nature, and then that's what's meant that they've not ended up being convicted of a particular sexual offence. But for the most part, it's quite clear when touching is sexual, when it's on your genitals or your breasts or under your clothes or done with certain kind of intent, accompanied with certain kinds of words in certain kinds of settings. But it really can be a very wide range of different behaviours. It's very clear this definition of consent when someone agrees by choice and has freedom and capacity, but the Act is also clear that consent can be conditional. Mm-hmm. And again, in our everyday lives, we understand this. We say, oh, I'll agree to doing that thing as long as X, Y, and Z happens or is put in place. And we accept that if the other person doesn't then put X, Y, and Z in place, then that agreement is invalidated because we've only agreed on the basis that they will do their part. And exactly the same is true when it comes to any kind of sexual contact, sexual activity. A common example is around the use of contraception, of condoms. So someone may reasonably consent to have sex with someone with a condom, and if the other person removes the condom without that original person's knowledge or consent, then they've invalidated the consent, and therefore anything that they do after that point is sexual assault or rape, depending on what happens between the two people. So that is really, really key as well.
Yeah, that's called stealthing, isn't it? When a man removes a condom and carries on with penetrative sex and doesn't tell the other person.
Yeah, it's become known as that. Colloquially, stealthing is a term that's used online and so on. It's not a legal definition, and actually what people refer to as stealthing would just be rape. There are lots of terms like that that have been used, you know, over the years to slightly minimise, slightly sanitise, slightly make certain behaviours sound like a bit of fun or something not that big of a deal. And on the one hand, I think sometimes these terms can be quite useful just because terms like rape are often really difficult for people to say. They're very misunderstood or they're long to explain. So sometimes it can be useful to have a shorthand or a nickname for something. But as long as we are clear that actually what we're talking about is just another form of rape, you know, there are other examples like upskirting or uphanding or something. That was explained to me once, some phrase that sounded like something so benign, and then when it was described to me, it was actually, you know, physically putting your hand up someone's skirt without their consent and sexually assaulting them.
Yeah, and sometimes when my children have come home from school, or my eldest is out of school now, and they tell me things and I say, that's sexual assault, that's sexual harassment. Mm. And I'm sure people must think I'm all terribly boring and serious, but I'm like, no, we need to call it what it is, because it's not harmless, actually. I know what happened to me in my school uniform coming home from school wasn't harmless and affected me for a really, really long time. But it was classed as just mucking about. It wasn't just mucking about. But that was why when I was 40 and I was telling someone what happened, they said that's sexual assault. And for a really long time, I thought, oh, don't make a fuss. It's not sexual assault. And it was only when I checked with a police officer and she said that's sexual assault that I allowed myself to say it. It's ridiculous. Who was I trying to protect?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quite a lot of the letters I get which have changed in recent times, something that makes me very concerned and very angry, is that since the whole 50 Shades of Grey, I've always said what people do that's consensual is up to them,
yeah,
as long as it's legal,
yeah,
and it's safe and they consent. But I get a lot of women, some of them very young, late teens, saying, my boyfriend wants to do this. I don't really want to, but he's said that I'm boring or it's vanilla. Mm. And without exception, the letters I get, it's to do with violence towards women, especially strangulation and choking. And obviously, I tell them that they don't have to do anything that they don't want to. Have things changed, do you think, in your experience? Do you hear that?
I mean, unfortunately, yes, I do think it's a common experience, perhaps for younger women and girls now, an even more common experience than it ever was. It's hard sometimes to extrapolate because, on the one hand, violent pornography and misogynistic attitudes and the glorification and sexualization of violence against women and girls and coercion within intimate relationships and all of that have all existed. But because of the internet, on the one hand, there's definitely an issue with more widespread, immediate access to ever more extreme and violent types of porn, which young people are increasingly even just stumbling across from incredibly young ages, from primary school ages. So on the one hand, there's that very real impact of how much more widespread it is. Endless surveys being done about what percentage of young men and boys in particular get their first introduction to any kind of sex or sexual content that way, and therefore begin to develop a very unhealthy kind of expectation or understanding about what enjoyable sexual encounters and relationships look like for all parties. But also, I suppose we should say that there's a potential benefit to the internet. There are forums and spaces where young people talk more and become more aware and more open. So it's hard to say sometimes whether all of this stuff happened anyway, but there were fewer means and outlets for young people to talk about it happening, and less awareness among young people of when it definitely is crossing over into something which is unacceptable, or whether it is just happening more because of the society in which we live. So it's impossible for me to say in a hard and fast way, but I know that I hate phrases like unfortunately or sadly, because it's enragingly, it's unacceptably, it's outrageously, not unfortunately or sadly, but we are at a place where a lot of young people, and I think young women and girls in particular, are in those situations. And it's terrible for young men and boys as well that they have been so sort of impacted by material that they've come across that they've kind of been desensitized and really believe that the only way to get sexual gratification is through certain kinds of practices. Now, you know, I should definitely caveat all of this by saying, as you started by saying yourself, that there's nothing wrong with BDSM type sexual activities between two, you know, fully aware and consenting adults who are communicating with each other and very much on the same page. Of course, there isn't. But it's being able to distinguish between that and a coercive situation. And the fact that someone is saying, I don't want to do this, but, means that they are not in an equal consenting situation. And going back to that original conversation about consent and what consent means, agreeing by choice and having the freedom and capacity to make that choice. If you've been constantly kind of griped at and got at by a partner who says that you're boring, that they're going to lose interest in you, that they're going to go elsewhere, that they're going to tell everyone that you're frigid, that there's something wrong with you, or whatever it may be. And if you've been constantly hectored with that messaging to the point where you give in or, you know, accept something because you think that you've really got no option, that is not consent. You know, that is not you making your own free choice about something. And anyone who's on the other side of those kinds of conversations needs to be well aware of that too. It's perfectly fine to have differing tastes and differing preferences within sexual relationships and to talk about that and negotiate that. But think about your language and think about how you're making the other person feel about the pressure that you're putting on. Because there's a world apart from saying, look, I'm interested in trying this thing. I think it would be sexy. I've seen it in a video or online and I'd like to try it. What do you think? There's worlds apart from that and saying, everybody's doing this. I really want to do it. If you don't want to do it, there's something wrong with you.
Yes, it's really important to say that. There's nothing wrong with not wanting to do stuff. The problem seems to be that the coercion, like you said, I mean, I think we keep having to come back to this consent, which is if you didn't want to do it or you didn't have time to think about whether you didn't want to do it, then you haven't given consent. I want to go back to something you were saying about men and boys. I mean, in other podcasts that I talked about, we've explained that pornography is not sex education. This is a difficult area because I certainly don't want to be seen to making excuses for perpetrators. But do you think that men and boys know what some of the parameters are? I mean, I didn't grow up in an environment where consent was talked about, but now there seems to be a lot of talk, quite rightly, about consent. And when I talk to mothers of boys, they generally don't seem to have sex talks with their sons, but they say things like, oh, they don't watch porn. And I think, but yes, they do, but they just haven't told you. Mm. I don't know from the letters I'm getting that men and boys really understand about consent. What's your view on that?
Yes, completely agree. I don't think young people or older people of any sex or gender understand consent for the most part. The definitions are out there and we're certainly making progress, and conversations like this, wider conversations in the media, in public and in family homes and in schools, are starting to make a difference. But the kind of cultural shift that we need to achieve in order to genuinely reach a point where everybody understands what healthy sexual relationships and encounters look like, and that consent is key to that, and what consent actually means, is vast. And that kind of cultural change doesn't happen overnight. So I certainly think that porn and the ubiquity of porn and the increasing violence and misogyny of mostly male-generated heterosexual mainstream pornography that is made for the making of vast amounts of profit, that definitely is a damaging, dangerous and influential part of the picture. But, you know, it's both a cause and a product of this wider, extremely misogynistic, patriarchal society in which we live. And it's all bound up with many of the other things, intersecting things that are wrong about our society, like racism, for example. And I think we are, as I say, starting to make some progress, but we have to not be under any illusion that it is just a school's responsibility or just a parent's responsibility or just even a politician's responsibility. politicians absolutely need to take some responsibility and lead from the front, and education in schools needs to be improved, and it is being, albeit gradually and faster in some individual schools and classrooms than others. But this is a collective responsibility for the benefit of everyone. I mean, I talk a lot about violence against women and girls because we can't deny that today, as historically, women and girls are disproportionately targeted by, impacted by the victims of sexual violence and abuse of all forms. And the vast majority of perpetrators of those sexual offences, rape, sexual assault, sexual abuse, are adult men. And that is still true today, and we do ourselves no favours by ignoring that fact, because that is it's an issue of equity. You know, if we don't recognise that we're in an inequitable situation in regards to sexual violence and abuse to start with, then we can't start to fix the problem. But it's important when I'm talking about violence against women and girls to not ignore A, that of course men and boys, and again people of all sexes and genders, do experience sexual violence and abuse, B, that people of all sexes and genders do perpetrate it, but over and above that, that regardless of who's doing it and who it's being done to, it's not just a women's issue or just an issue for over there. And in fact, you know, arguably parents of sons have a greater responsibility or have a greater part to play than parents of daughters, because traditionally I too went to school and learned sex education, and the most progressive it got was being taught about contraception. There was nothing about the emotions or the social aspects of sex, and certainly nothing about consent and how non-consensual sexual encounters and relationships can impact on you psychologically, physically, emotionally for the rest of your life. There was no talk of that. And now those kinds of topics are meant to be in all curriculums. You know, the government did bring in compulsory relationships and sex education for all schools. But inevitably, it's going to take some time for that content to have a trickle-down effect, and for, you know, those young people to leave school and become adults and start to have an influence on the next generation, because sadly their parents' generation and everyone else out there doesn't have that level of understanding because of the situations that we've been in for so long. I think I've made that sound like a very like a very bleak situation, but I think it's just to say that we can't underestimate how global the issue is and the importance of having these conversations.
No, and given that I grew up with the message of don't be raped, you know, that message of, well, you know, you were out late at night, you were wearing this, and, you know, as an adult, I kind of correct that now. But given that, what do we want to say to men and boys or perpetrators of sexual violence? What would we like to say to them?
What I've said in the past and what I still always come back to is, why would you want to do anything sexual or intimate with someone if you weren't 100% confident that they wanted to do it too? All of it, everything that you were doing. Why would you want to do that if you weren't confident that both of you were into it, both of you were enjoying it, both of you were getting something from it? The obvious answer of why you would want to is that you have a lack of empathy for that other person. And this is why it's wider and more societal, because we live in still a patriarchal, misogynistic society that dehumanizes and commodifies women and women's bodies, and, you know, and in general for so long, not just in the home, because it's so much more than in individual households where all the parental influences and other influences, sibling influences, might be great, might be really positive and affirming and fantastic and empathic. But everyone still lives in a world full of advertising and films and magazines and the internet and all of these kinds of subliminal influences and messages that are coming at us all the time, that objectify women, that reduce them to sexual objects primarily for the enjoyment of heterosexual men. And I think we need to start, therefore, with a basis of empathy. So appealing to men and boys, to all young people, to just remember when you're in any sexual encounter, any kind of relationship, that that other person is a person too, and try to put yourself in their shoes and try to think about what they might be feeling and why they might find it hard to express to you that they don't want something and how that might feel to them. You know, really, I think that empathy and having basic human regard for one another, even if it's just a one-night stand, you know, even if this is just someone you've picked up on a night out, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But just because you don't know them well or don't love them doesn't mean you can't have care for them, human empathy for them, or that you shouldn't be bothered about the impact that your behaviour is having on them. So really, I think it's as basic as that. And that's why I think it's really important to make a start on this kind of education when kids are really, really young. I think people are really scared when you start to talk about sex education or relationships education in terms of like primary school age kids or younger, because they think that you're teaching kids about sex, you know, too early and it's inappropriate.
Yeah, they think it's prescriptive. You teach them, they're going to go and do it. But exactly. Actually, the research shows the opposite.
Exactly. And also, there's just so many age-appropriate ways to start to talk to kids about things like the concept of bodily autonomy. I'm not a parent myself, but I'm a step-parent and an auntie and a godmother. And I've been guilty of and witnessed young children being told to give so-and-so a hug.
Oh, yeah.
And being told to, not asked if they want to, and actually being sort of told off for being rude or something else if they don't submit to physical contact with an adult. Well, that is actually a really dangerous message to be teaching.
Yeah, it's very early consent. I think you're being very kind in a way to sort of perpetrators, because I think violence is about power. And I think that's something that's way beyond the scope of this episode. But I think violence against women is about power. And I think maybe as a society, we need to look at why men feel they need to have power over women.
Yeah, I guess when you said, what do you want to say to men and boys? I'm starting off by thinking of boys. You know, I'm thinking of my 6-year-old nephew or my 10-year-old godson or my new baby grandson. And I'm thinking, you know, what do I want to teach them? What are the messages for them? What do I want to model for them?
And I want to
teach them about empathy and love and respect and care and respecting other people's boundaries, respecting other people's no's, reading into those silences what other people might be thinking or feeling, a bit in the same way that women and girls are socialised to do from the youngest possible age. I remember from a young age being really super sensitive, and I still am now. I'm trying to unlearn some of it almost, to what impact my words and behaviours might have on other people in every situation. So it's just sharing a bit of that out, I think, is what I'm talking about. But you are right, and this is, I mean, I can't stress this enough either, because this comes to the heart of when we're working with survivors in rape crisis centres at Sarsville and other places up and down the country, where, as I mentioned earlier, you know, survivors so often come to us blaming themselves and making excuses for a perpetrator because they just can't believe that someone would knowingly or willingly have caused them so much pain and heartache and trauma and distress, and they're trying to find an explanation because it's really hard to accept that someone would want to do that to them, especially someone with whom they're in a relationship or who they've trusted as a friend or who they've worked with for however many months or years. But ultimately, you know, what survivors need to hear, what those who've had this done to them need to hear, is that ultimately perpetrators have a choice, and they are choosing to do something, and there are no kind of mitigating circumstances. It's not okay to say, oh, you know, they were upset because they lost their job or because their wife's gone off them or because they're depressed or because they drink or whatever else it may be, because ultimately, you know, rape and sexual assault and other forms of sexual violence and abuse are absolutely crimes of power and control and violence. I do say this quite often, rape is as different from sex as drowning is from swimming. They both happen in the water, and that's pretty much where the similarity ends. And we don't talk about swimming without breathing, in the same way that people talk about sex without consent. That's a nonsense. There's no such thing as sex without consent, because as soon as there's no consent, it's rape. It's not sex anymore.
Yeah, and rape isn't about sex. I grew up with films where the man was so overcome by sexual desire for this woman that he sort of forced her, and it was almost romanticised.
Yes.
And actually, it's not about sexual desire. And what I explained to one young woman who was saying, you know, is it me? I said, you know, I've seen lots of men that I find attractive. Sometimes they're drunk. Sometimes they're not wearing much clothing. I've never touched them.
No.
And that's the choice I've made. Mm. And it doesn't matter what you're wearing. It doesn't matter what you've said. It doesn't matter what you've consented to up till that point. They've made a choice. And I think by putting it like that, like saying, well, have you ever done that? It kind of makes people realise what it actually is about. Rape isn't about desire. It's about power.
Yes. Oh, I mean, I absolutely, 100%. And that's another way in which we as individuals and society tries to excuse rapists and sexually violent men, is this total myth of their sexual desire being stronger than women's, which is nonsense, and being uncontrollable in a way that women's isn't. Because you could bet that man who is overcome with desire, if their grandma suddenly walked in the room or something else happened that they didn't like, they would be able to stop. And they should have that same response to somebody not wanting to have sex with them. That should be as much of a turn-off as any other thing. It's about someone asserting their power and control. It's violence and it's domination.
Yeah. And another message I think that's useful is that if it's not an active yes, then it's a no.
Oh, yeah. It's been suggested to me before, should you get someone to sign to say that they've consented then? I mean, you could, but it would
be... Then you might change your mind halfway through.
Exactly. The contract would be valid for the second that the person was signing their name, because this is the other thing about consent. It's not permanent. It can be given, it can be refused, and it can be withdrawn at any moment. There have been high-profile cases of people saying in the past, oh, they consented to having sex with me before, and I didn't think I needed to seek permission every time. And they're like, you absolutely do need to seek permission every time. Consent is not like a pass that you get issued with and then that's it. So the fact that someone's wanted to have sex with you 5 minutes before and then they've changed their mind, that should be enough for you. And it's a constant, it's a live concept, which is also why when we're in sexual encounters with people, we should be constantly checking in with them and making sure that things are still okay, because someone may have really enthusiastically consented to having sex with you in theory, and then they might pass out. It might turn out that they drank more than you thought they had. And that would definitely be rape if you continued in that situation with them. And I hope most people would recognise that. And it's the same in any circumstance in which things have changed for that other person. And it may just be that their feelings have changed and they've decided, actually, I don't want to do this. And that should always be enough for you. That is okay.
Why, in your experience, do you think that survivors blame themselves so much?
I think, for the most part, because we live in society, I'm going to say it again, but our white supremacist, heteropatriarchal, capitalist society is a victim-blaming one and has been historically, and it's certainly the world that I grew up in. So no matter the individual great influences you might have in your life, be it a fantastic teacher or parent or friend, it can be really, really hard, in the same way that it can be hard for us to resist toxic messages about body image, even though we know people don't really look like that and it's all nonsense and all of the rest of it. Even though we know that intellectually, it can be really hard for us to resist those messages on a more sort of gut level. I think that's a deep part of it. So a lot of us have absorbed victim blaming myths and stereotypes to the point where we think that if we do, especially as women, this is highly gendered, I don't think you can avoid it, we're bombarded with these messages of, as long as you don't walk home alone after dark, And if you absolutely have to, as long as you've got your keys between your fingers, and as long as you message someone when you leave and message someone when you arrive, and as long as when you always know how you're going to get home safely from a night out, and as long as you don't drink too much, and as long as you don't go back to someone's for coffee, and as long as you don't wear these certain things, I mean, the list is absolutely endless. Mm-hmm. But if you were someone who managed to not do all of those things, not give someone the wrong look or whatever, you believe, you've been told that those are the things that will keep you safe. So then if something has happened to you that you haven't wanted, you think, I must have applied those rules incorrectly, or there must have been something that I didn't quite do right. We can all find things. I had that one drink too many, or I should have gone home, or I shouldn't have said that to him because that could have been misinterpreted, or whatever it may be. I think it's that victim blaming myths that have been internalised to the point where it's just so, so incredibly difficult to resist them. Just compounds and adds to the enduring trauma of these experiences, because any kind of traumatic experience, but few of them so universally, are also compounded by this feeling of self-blame and societal blame and judgment from others and shame. So that really is another big part of what we try to do in the Rape Crisis Movement at Sarsville and across the country and the world, is try to raise awareness and understanding and break down stigmas and myths and stereotypes around sexual violence and abuse, who it's done to and who it's done by and all of the rest of it, because that is a way to ultimately, I believe, reduce and end sexual violence and abuse, which is our main goal. But it's also the way to reduce the harm for victims and survivors and increase the likelihood of them being able to access the criminal and the social justice that they need and want and deserve after an experience like that. So reporting to the police may be what they want to do. If it's not, a rape crisis centre would never pressure them to do that. It would give them all the information and support to enable them to if they wanted to. But if they didn't want to, again, this is about them being allowed to have power and control back over their own lives and making decisions that feel right to them.
Anyone listening to this who thinks, I think I have been raped, or I think I have been sexually assaulted, What can we say to them? And following on from that is, if you know someone who has, we've talked about just how incredibly important language is. What might we say to them?
Okay, great. So I'll start with the first question. If this has happened to you, or you think this has happened to you, whatever you're feeling or not feeling is fine. It's normal and it's yours and it's valid and it's okay. Because I think sometimes when we're in these situations, and you know, we've talked about blaming ourselves and everything else, but we can feel like maybe our response is wrong. We feel numb, we feel angry, we feel tearful, we didn't immediately cut the perpetrator out of our lives. So first and foremost, this is your experience. You have done nothing wrong. This is not your fault, and everything that you're thinking and feeling now is valid, and it's yours, and it's okay. Secondly, it's entirely up to you what happens next. You deserve to be able to make the choices about what you do or don't want to do as a result of what you've been through. But whatever else, in my experience, I would say, talking to someone safe, to the right person, can almost always help, even if it doesn't lead to action or doing anything else. So if you don't have someone safe or trusted in your life that you would feel comfortable to talk to about this thing, then I would go online and look for the National 24/7 Sexual Violence Helpline, which is run by Rape Crisis England and Wales, or for your local specialist sexual violence and abuse support charity, which might be something like Support After Rape and Sexual Violence Needs, where I work, which is a rape crisis centre, or another similar independent organisation specialising in support after rape and other forms of sexual violence and abuse, because there you will be listened to, you will be believed, and no pressure will be put on you to take any action or make any decisions that you don't feel comfortable with or ready for. I would say that. And then leading on from that, if someone discloses to you that they've been through the trauma of any kind of sexual violence or abuse, it can be scary, it can be intimidating, and it can be really easy to worry about saying or doing the wrong thing, especially as we've talked about, you know, the importance of words and everything else. I would remember that the fact they've come to you in the first place is an honour. You know, it's a credit to you. It means that you are someone that they consider safe and that they trust to an extent. They've put their trust in you, so you could also in return trust that they've made the right choice in coming to you. But I think that first and foremost, and it sounds so simple as to be almost ridiculous, listen. And I mean really, really listen to what they're telling you. And it might take ages and there might be loads of pauses and it might be really, really difficult to sit with. But try not to interrupt. Try not to put words into their mouth. Try not to ask loads of questions, even though that might feel instinctive. First and foremost, listen to them, hear them and believe them. And then, once you've done all that, you might like to start to ask them open questions about what they'd like to do next. You might like to start to tell them about those kinds of rape crisis and other specialist services that are out there. But I would just try to hold off on that instinct to ask loads of questions and say things like, why didn't you do X, Y, and Z? Because those are the things that can be very painful to hear and that can feed into that feeling of self-blame. And it can come from a very understandable place. Again, it might trigger an experience that you've had in your own life, or a memory that's very painful for you to deal with. It might trigger your own fears about whether something like this could happen to you. But just because your friend or loved one or whoever's come to you hasn't necessarily reacted or responded in the way that you think you might do in the same situation, just remember that everyone is different. It's not the same as the situation you've been through in the past or might go through in the future. This is theirs, and let them lead, I would say. But finally, if you are supporting someone who is a victim or survivor of sexual violence or abuse, also just be kind to yourself and recognise that even though it's their experience, it's them who's been through this thing, and it's for them to decide what happens next. It can be really hard to hear all of that for you as well, especially if it taps into things that you've been through in your own life. So again, this is like the National Sexual Violence Helpline and your local Rape Crisis Centre. They can be there to support you as well. And there's lots of advice and resources on their websites, and there's helplines people to talk to if you need to be able to do that in confidence without, of course, breaking the confidence of the person you're supporting.
And also just to pick up on something and response I often get if I answer something like this in my column is that people say you have to report them, and I point out in my reply that when you've been the survivor of sexual violence, all the power and control has been taken away from you. So it's really important afterwards that you feel you do have the power and control. And it's really not up to the survivor to stop the perpetrator reoffending. And whatever they decide to do, they should be supported in that, whether it be reporting it to the police, which is obviously quite a contentious issue at the moment, or not doing anything. It's really important, isn't it, to listen to them and support them in what they want to do, because also they may change their mind in a month or two. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, no matter what you think is the right thing or what you think you might do in the same situation, an experience of sexual violence and abuse is so disempowering. And this person, this survivor in front of you, they deserve to be able to take back power and control over their own life and decide what feels right for them and what to do next. And that might be reporting to the police, or it might not be. And going through the criminal justice system process is difficult. There's no denying that. And there's lots that we can say about the state of the criminal justice system at the moment. So if they choose to report, there's support for them out there. And that's something you can encourage and support them with as much as you like. But it might be that they don't make that choice. That choice isn't right for them. And it certainly is not their responsibility to stop someone offending or reoffending in future. What may or may not happen to other victims of the same perpetrator will never be their fault. It will always and only be the perpetrator's fault. They are the ones making those decisions, those harmful decisions, and taking that harmful action, not the survivor.
Yeah, we're certainly not saying that people shouldn't report it, but no, it should be led by the survivor. Katie, a really, really difficult subject. Thank you so much for your insights. Thanks so much to Katie, who was able to talk so calmly, coherently, and with such authority on what is a very upsetting subject. We rightly talked a lot about consent in this episode, and although we did so in the context of sexual practices, which is of course an adult pursuit, teaching children about consent and ownership over their bodies starts at age zero. In the episode bio, I've linked to a couple of articles I've written about this subject. If you or someone you know has been affected by the subject matter of this episode, you can get help and support by putting in the words rape crisis and the county you live in into Google. I've put some other links for various other organisations in the episode bio, including one that's specifically for men and boys. The 24-hour helpline Katie mentions is on 0808 500 2222. Thanks for listening. The producer is Hester Kant, the music is by Toby Dunham, and our artwork is by Lo Cole. If you'd like to read my column, it appears every Saturday in The Guardian Saturday magazine.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, this is Annalisa. I started doing this podcast because it's an idea I really believe in, so much so that I decided to put my money where my mouth is and self-fund the project. I really want to keep releasing this podcast for free, so if you enjoy this episode, a way you can help is to visit our Acast supporter page and give what you can. You'll find the link in the episode description. Thank you.